Thank you very much. And I also want to thank the organizers for their generosity in including our pre-conference tutorial this year. It meant a lot to us, to my wife and I who run Crane Soft Rights. It meant a lot to us. So thank you to the organizers for their generosity in letting us run the pre-conference tutorial. I'm trying something different at this conference. I'm not going to show you a lot of angle brackets. I want you to think about things, and I feel a bit constrained because the camera is facing this way. I have to stay in front of them. Those of you who have seen me teach know that I have to walk around the room and I have to wave my pointer and draw my lines and stuff. I'm going to try not to do that because I want this to be more of a cerebral presentation. I want you to think about things that aren't angle brackets because they will be important to you, or they should be important to you. I am feeling a bit daunted because I am about to present something that someone I very much respect in Michael Kay apparently calls ludicrous. And it is the basic theme of my presentation today. And at least one person thinks it's ludicrous. I want us to think about the role of codes in XML documents. Now, we've had angle brackets for a long time, since the early 80s. We've been marking up documents. I have friends in this room that I've been involved with markup since I got involved in 1992, back in the SGML days. And only in the last 5 years did I learn about the use of codes in documents, in business documents. You know, you may not have known that I've branched out from the style sheet and query world into the e-commerce world and UBL, the Universal Business Language. I've been playing in that sandbox for about 6 or 7 years, and there was a technical problem in UBL that I've been able to address, and we'll talk about that today. But it opened my eyes as an angle bracket guy to this world of codes that have been around for centuries. Codes in documents have been around for centuries. I've seen stagecoach report documents where at the bottom of the list is a 999 for a wildcard code value for representing some kind of luggage that wasn't in their code list. So code lists have been around for centuries, and we XML designers and implementers have got to implement them for our users whether we like them or not. So, at this forum, I'm going to try and get you to think not of angle brackets, but of codes as first-class information items that we have to manage for our users, or that we have to equip our users to manage for themselves. Ooh. How often have we tried to let our users manage codes for themselves, or information, excuse me, for themselves? So what I've done is I've excerpted a number of slides from a day-long tutorial I have on these technologies. I'm just going to point you guys to the folks, excuse me, you folks, to the specifications. I'll let you read the specifications on the angle brackets. You'll understand what I'm saying in the specifications, and I'm not here to read you the specifications. So I want to think quite cerebrally about information and the kind of information we're used to managing with angle brackets and the kind of information our business users have been trying to manage for centuries, and we have to somehow shoehorn their concepts of codes into an information management framework that allows us to dictate where these codes belong and allows our users to manage the codes, because we who are on committees cannot expect to know what our users are going to need on a day-by-day basis. So, and I do mean day-by-day, because business relationships change day-by-day. Committee specs don't. And I just want to echo the comment that was made by Mike Kay about volunteerism and work on committees. He's talked about the committees on the W3C and the efforts already. Makoto has talked about the number of people and the writing of guidelines on the ISO committees. I'll talk about the number of people on the OASIS committees. We all need help. So if you can find a way to volunteer, and perhaps if you can encourage university people to volunteer their efforts in standardization committees and work, it will give them exposure, it'll give them experience in working with these technologies, it'll give them an opportunity to contribute. I hope to echo for the W3C, for ISO, and for OASIS that all of these committees need help. But back to the business at hand. I want us to realize there are two kinds of vocabularies in our documents when we're dealing with business documents. There's this vocabulary labeling the branches in our structured information, and we have a technology called XML that allows us to express our information in a tree, to label all of the branches, and to validate that our use of the labels of our information is correct, so that our applications can identify and find the information in our documents in order for our applications to implement those semantics. Okay, so we all know that. I'm preaching to the converted here. But inside those documents are codes, identifiers, information items that have controlled vocabularies. Now, at the break, I heard about the hackles being raised at the word code and code lists. Well, I think the generic term is a controlled vocabulary. That term has been used for a while. And these are values that don't impact on the structure, but they are important to the application. They represent semantics that trading partners and communities are going to base their business decisions on, their business practices on. And we want to be able to manage these important values in our XML documents. That means we have some responsibilities that I want to share with you, because if you are going to go and design documents that are going to work with semantics represented by codes, you have some responsibilities that I want to share with you so that you can leave here with those in mind. Well, a controlled vocabulary is some set of agreed upon values. And I've got some examples here. We all know about country codes, currency codes. I was quite interested to learn about the standardized list of transaction payment means. It has been around for a long time now. Payment by credit card, payment by cash, payment by deposit to a bank account. All of these are our transaction payment means, and the codes for these have been standardized for a long time. Units of measure, again, a long time. Now, contrast a code with an identifier. You have units of measure and you have things being measured. Well, those things being measured are identifiers. The unit of measure is a characteristic of the thing being measured. I might have a list of training products, books, products, videos that I sell. I want to have identifiers, a controlled vocabulary of identifiers where each value is representing some semantic. Now, we've been managing information in trees, but I don't think many of us in this room have been managing these codes, managing these identifiers. And so I want to talk about how we can do that, because when two parties are using our technology to get information from point A to point B, we want to make sure that the codes used in these documents are going to represent the same semantic, the same meaning. Otherwise, we might be paying invoices for totally different things than we think we are because we have a misunderstanding of what these codes represent. So there's some obvious enumerated concepts, and we have data types in our schemas for enumerations that a piece of information is programmatically is going to be either value A or value B. Well, there's a public vocabulary like currency code when we want to represent that a payment is in US dollars or British pounds. We have codes that represent those semantics, those concepts, and we're going to agree upon those concepts so that we're actually outlaying the correct amount of money. But just between two trading partners, they might have nuances of meaning or their own representation of codes between two trading partners. So we need an information management structure in order to handle these different kinds of concepts. Well, necessarily, these codes have to be unique in a given list because we're trying to avoid ambiguity. So we need a representation that collects these unique values in a list. So we need some list metadata in order to identify the list from which we get this code. Thinking about relational database keys, each key has to be unique, but we can have multiple tables. So we need some kind of information management for identifying the list as a whole. And we need information management to talk about the values in that list. And yes, in W3C schema, we have the annotation facilities, app info, that allow us to create custom structures that can contain value level metadata. But I want us to think outside of that. I want to think outside of any particular schema language. And the analogy to value level metadata is the columns that are associated with the key itself. Now, unfortunately, some terminology in our industry has been influenced by ISO. They tend to call the value the code and to call the description the name. Now, this has been awkward because when I've been dealing with people who are new to XML, but they are not new to ISO code lists, they talk about the code and the name. And in our project work in UBL, we have maintained this uncomfortable use of terminology between the name and the description. Well, these are typically abbreviations. One of the goals is to be nice and short with the code, but there are other goals where the representation may or may not be meaningful without some kind of cross-reference. And so you get into mnemonic codes, USD. I'm pretty sure everyone would probably recognize what USD is in its context, right? When we're talking about currencies, we probably would accept what USD stands for. Another issue about mnemonics is mnemonic in which language? I have to tell my fellow North Americans that SP is not an appropriate abbreviation for Spanish. That España is Spanish for Spain, and ES is the appropriate abbreviated code. We have to be careful about language when we're dealing with mnemonics. So if we start getting away from mnemonics and we start have non-mnemonic codes, 42, the answer. What is it? What is the question? Well, apparently it's what is it for the transaction payment means. Apparently 42 means payment to bank account. Okay, so I've got an XML document and I see the value 42. What does that mean? So, what is the question? Well, we have to know what is the context of use, what is the list that we're using, what version of the list. Perhaps 42 has changed over the years to mean something else. We have to manage this kind of information. I like the fact that codes are abbreviated. From the same code list, 51 Can you imagine someone putting this value into an XML document correctly so that our programs would unambiguously identify this kind of French standard by having our users type this value accurately every time? I think codes really do have an important role because they promote a consistent interpretation of the value when we have managed it appropriately and we have given our users the tools to manage what these codes mean. Okay, now a religious question. What is a code and what is an identifier? Many people feel these are interchangeable. I'd like to think that they do have a distinction. I tend to use codes for characteristics, and I tend to use identifiers for lookup values. And again, the difference between a currency code for an account and identification of which account is the difference between a code and identifier. A measurement of meters or the identification of which measurement, the gross width or the net width. So, this is not hard and fast. That's why I say the word typically. Many people will interchangeably use this. I have found even in the UBL schemas, there are things they call codes, which I would have called an identifier, but they didn't ask me at the time. And nevertheless, we have these values in our documents, and trading partners may want to constrain all of the codes that are available. Think about I live in Canada, and I do a lot of business in the U.S. My bank is telling me I may be able to get to deal with euros soon, but right now I can only deal with US dollars and Canadian dollars. And I have a whole ISO list of currency codes, but in my trading arrangement, I only want to use US dollars and Canadian dollars. So I want to manage my use of this controlled vocabulary. I want to express that I only want a controlled vocabulary of US dollars and Canadian dollars, but I want them to represent the semantics that are in the standardized list. I want to say that my USD means US dollars as defined by ISO. So that's just an example of trading partners wanting to constrain code lists or maybe even augment them, add something new. There are custodians out there of the abstract concept of a code list. They manage these in their own ways. They might be using databases. I've seen a lot of pros lists. Here is the code list, and they give me a PDF file. And I'm supposed to manage my code list with a PDF file. Well, I have seen enumerations and schemas. Very popular to see CSV files. They might be managing them as database tables. Inventing their own colloquial vocabulary, or I'd like to propose using a standardized XML vocabulary for code lists that has a lot of these management features. Already, many concepts are officially maintained. Currency codes and country codes are maintained at ISO. UN CFACT, committee underneath UNECE is responsible for the payment means codes. That means our users, or if they've given the responsibility to us XMLers, we're going to have to decide which of these codes are applicable in our space. We're going to have to find the custodians, find which organizations are acceptable to trading partners to determine those codes that represent the semantics we need to use in our information. That's a design a community responsibility designing the interchange of documents. They're going to have to decide whose controlled vocabularies are we going to use. We might then decide to subset those codes, as I gave you in my example. I want to use the ISO code list for currency, but I only want to use two codes from that. many people need to extend official code lists. There is a code list for transportation status. And one of the UBL documents reports transportation status in an XML structure. UNCFACT has transportation status codes, and the US Department of Transport has status concepts that are not included in that list. And they have decided that in the management of information with UBL, they need to represent both this official semantics plus their custom semantics. So that introduces a management requirement. It also introduces a new facet of conformance or of validation. And what's happened in UBL is we have formally separated UBL conformance from code list conformance. And I'm going to be bringing that up in a diagram later. But we actually have formally separated two aspects of conformance when using UBL. I'm going to be referring to UBL a lot here. Although these techniques happened to have been developed to satisfy UBL, they are available for all vocabularies, whether it's a business vocabulary, a scientific vocabulary, all vocabularies that have controlled vocabularies. UBL, why is that important to Europeans? There is an edict. 5 years ago, the European Union said every member of the European Union has to do public procurement electronically by 2010, next year. There aren't a lot of vocabularies out there. In fact, I think only UBL satisfies the requirement, and there are a couple of projects. Please talk to me during the breaks if you have any questions about procurement standards, business standards in Europe next year for the 2010 goal, because I'm a co-editor of the UBL spec and I love to talk about UBL. So we'll do that. So, but as a community of users, there is a committee called the BII that is specifying the requirements for public procurement in Europe, and they have this responsibility. They have to decide which codes to use, which codes to extend, what do these codes mean, how are they represented, which values do we not care to constrain, do we want to leave unconstrained. All of these are options. Well, in the management of this information, I want to talk about three kinds of metadata. The list level metadata is identifying the actual list of codes that have the unique values. And I have on the left here the UNCFACT payment means code, which has hundreds of values. And what if I'm in a situation where I only need to use cash or certified check? That's in my business practice. I only want to accept of all of these codes 10 and 25, cash and certified check. So I'm going to create a code list whose list level metadata is my own list level metadata. One of the lessons I've learned in this management of information is you can't subset the ISO list and call it the ISO list from a management perspective, because it isn't the ISO list. This is my list of ISO codes. So I've introduced into this management philosophy the concept of a masquerade, where I have created Ken's code list of just cash and certified, but at the point of validation, I'm going to masquerade this as if it were the official CFACT list. And the masquerade satisfies the semantic association. The fact that even though it's Ken's code list, you don't have to know it's Ken's code list for 10, because the masquerade says that this 10 means whatever ISO says, or whatever UNCFACT says this value 10 means. So I'm managing my list with my own list level metadata, but there is the concept of the masquerade, which says that these values come from this table for semantic purposes. And what if I want to add a new payment means? Perhaps I come from a southern region and I have a new currency in my trading agreements and I want to include this in my instances. Well, I could have then an alternative set of payment means and list my codes there. This diagram also shows another aspect about document context, because what if, for whatever reason, in my XML documents, I want to have different lists applicable at different contexts of my document? Well, one of the aspects of UBL modeling is that every information item is globally declared with a global type, which means the values have global scope, which means if I use XSD enumerations, I can't do this kind of document contextual differences in the controlled vocabularies that apply. So in this management scheme, we've addressed that. We are supporting the ability to say that at this point of my XML document, I want the full UNC fact list to apply. At this part of the document, I want this controlled subset. And at this point of the document, not only do I want my subset, but I also want to allow this value. And I am doing that association of document context with the lists that apply, the values that apply. Okay, now, that's list-level metadata. The value-level metadata is helping me understand these codes. And the first two columns here are labeled with the ISO names of code and name. And in the first issue of UBL, we only published code and name per the ISO approach, and we ended up with this ambiguity. The name was insufficient to distinguish the code for users. Users wouldn't know from the name, they wouldn't know which code to use. Value level metadata is so important. When you are describing your codes, this is the unique column, or perhaps a combination of columns to make a unique column, you need value level metadata to help convey what the semantics of this code mean. Now, that might involve normative values that are crucial to the distinction of these codes. It might include informative values like language translations. Wouldn't it be nice in managing this code list to have a user go to the code, to the value level metadata, and see a translation of what the semantic is meant to represent? So we have value level metadata, code level, list level metadata, value level metadata, and something that we designers need to remember is instance level metadata. When we design our vocabularies, we have a responsibility when dealing with codes to give our users the opportunity to distinguish the semantic of a code by indicating list level metadata in the instance. UBL accommodates this. There are attributes to information items where you specify the list level metadata from which the code comes, so that my application, when it sees a code, will know which list it comes from. Now, I've slightly changed my union here. I have a union of these two lists. If I use the value 25 somewhere in my XML document, that's unambiguously certified check. Well, what about the value 10? If I just put the value 10, notice that I'm reusing that value from two lists. Now, these lists are managed by different custodians. They have their own reasons for coming up with their values. So we can't mandate or dictate to these custodians to use unique values. So here I have two separate lists with the value 10. If my user says 10, they need to be able to say, from which list does this 10 code come? It comes from the UNC fact list version 7A. Or this comes from the alternative payment means list. Now, if we design an XML vocabulary and we forget to give them this power and we only let them specify a code, that might be ambiguous to an application. So I want you to remember your responsibility when designing a vocabulary, a business document vocabulary that's or any document that's using codes, to provide instance-level metadata. And this is where the masquerade comes into play. Because I'm saying this is 10 from the UNC fact list, when in fact, behind the scenes, it's 10 from Ken's list, but I am masquerading Ken's list as if it were the UNC fact list to make sure that the semantics are agreed upon. So those are the three. I want you to leave here with a respect for list-level metadata, value-level metadata, and instance-level metadata. Well, how to model these? I see these really as sparse tables is what I see these as. Tables where the codes are indicated in one column and you may have sparse or full metadata in the other column. How you maintain this behind the scenes is up to you. You might use a database, you might use any kind of information. I've seen uses of spreadsheets, word processing, CSV files. And when you try to trade these files as part of legal contractual agreements, they might be difficult to be unambiguous. So, what do we have available to us? Bless you. We could be using something like a W3C schema enumeration. In our use of, have them call back. They might be, like UBL, have document-wide scope of reuse, which means we can't have these contextual differences of the different code lists. There is a standardized XML vocabulary for controlled vocabularies, for these code lists. It allows us to specify list-level metadata and value-level metadata. It's still your responsibility to design in the instance-level metadata for your users, but at least we have an XML spec for list-level metadata and value-level metadata. And it is not meant just for validation. It is also meant for any purpose, like I'll talk about data entry in a sec. Now, there is still a role for schema expressions, and that's what I said. When you design your schemas, please provide for your users to specify optional instance-level metadata. Oh, right here, data entry. Wouldn't it be nice in a user interface, when you are offering to your user a drop-down list, in that drop-down list to only use the subset of codes that you want to apply in the trading partner relationship? And if the user has a question about one of those codes, wouldn't it be nice to expose all of the value-level metadata about that code? So, generic code satisfies the value-level metadata and the list of values for the drop-down list. Now, the instance-level metadata, you could be populating that, because what if you've indicated that an information item is the union of two lists with an ambiguous value, the number 10? So you want to select the number 10, you can say, from which list have I selected the number 10? And the data entry package would auto-populate the instance-level metadata to do the disambiguation. Applications. What I found interesting is that this approach to using codes allows very generic applications to be written. Imagine that payment means code list, okay? Many different kinds of payment means. If I'm writing an application working with UBL, I might support 2 or 3 dozen different kinds of payment means in my application. And I can write that code once. Okay, I've got this application working on transaction payment means. And in my trading partner relationship with Priscilla, we're doing this business together. She wants from me only cash or certified check. She can constrain in our XML instances the use of only cash and certified check from instances of me, even though her application supports 36 different kinds of payment means. As our trading partner relationship matures, she can accept more payment means from me, and she doesn't have to change the schema, she doesn't have to change the application, she only changes the validation of those XML documents that she gets from me, because she is allowing more values to get through to the application. And you have now supported a new trading partner relationship with zero programming changes. All you've done is change the code list that's involved. It's very flexible for trading partner relationships. And this came up with UBL. We're trying to design a business vocabulary, and who are we to say what a business trading relationship is going to be at any point in time, or it's going to change in time. As she trusts me more, she's going to allow more payment means. I can't express that in a schema. We have to manage those as first-class information items. This also offloads some of the validation responsibility. So I don't have to change my application to know about the trading partner relationship, because the validation in advance of the application will reflect the flexible requirement. So I've drawn that here in this diagram, and I've cited as examples in UBL what might be uncomfortable with: the separation of the validation of structure constraints, structure and lexical constraints, from value constraints. Okay, structural constraints from value constraints. The proposed processing model for UBL is to have the recipient of an XML document go through two distinct stages of validation before passing that instance to an application. So Priscilla's written an application, she's supporting 36 different kinds of payment means. She receives an XML instance from me. Well, she first uses the UBL schemas, the published committee schemas, or the community subset configurations, to ensure that the structure is valid and the structure of the values, which is the lexical validation. So both of these are structural aspects of my document. Is my use of the labels correct, and is my representation of the value inside that correct? If so, then let's now check the validation of the values themselves. To help our, and this also illustrates the two kinds of conformance. We have UBL conformance, and we have code list conformance. And it's the responsibility of a community to dictate, when dealing with us, we expect you to conform to this UBL schema and this set of code lists. Separate facets of validation that we have to communicate to our users, implemented this way. Now, we supply to our user community a default code list. We've chosen, for 91 different coded information items, we've chosen 12 code lists that will be popularly used, and we publish this as a second pass schema. A second pass set of constraints. And it happens to be XSLT. It could be anything at all. It happens to be XSLT for UBL, and I'll talk about XSLT in a sec. Now, if a user of UBL chooses to change those constraints, so Priscilla wants to do business with me, she will change the second pass to only allow certified check or cash from me. She'll accept more from Norm, she'll accept more from Jenny, but from me she'll just do cash until we get to know each other, and then she changes this validation. She hasn't changed the UBL schema. All along we've been conforming to UBL, but this reflects the changing trading partner relationship, and the application supports it all. Now, how do we get there? We We have chosen XSLT to give to our user community because I was able to create a schematron implementation of what are called context value association files, pulling in those generic code files, and that approach allows us to bring in business rules as well as schematron assertions, and this all gets assimilated into a single XSLT style sheet. So the last thing I want to show to you, I'm just going to skip ahead to the vocabulary. Okay, that's the generic code vocabulary. There's pretty print style sheets so that you don't have... Oh, that's another thing. My business users don't like seeing angle brackets. You know, we're comfortable with angle brackets. They don't like seeing angle brackets. So there are published style sheets, and we just add these style sheet association instructions into the generic code files. Here's the list level metadata at the top, definition of the columns, which columns are keys, and there's my row with the exchange of sheep as my additional payment means. But we've seen angle brackets before. The last diagram I want to show before answering questions is this diagram that talks about a context value association file, a CVA file. This is an XML instance that declaratively specifies for different document contexts by using XPath addresses the association between those contexts and pointers to generic code files. And you can specify that one generic code file has the context here. This second one here appears to be the union of two different generic code files, and this third document context is a single generic code file. So this is what the business trading partner relationship reflects inside the standardized structure. That in doing business with Ken, only use that subset list, which is check and cash, and later on change that pointer to point to the larger list, not having to change my application, just changing this association of which values are applicable in which contexts. So, I'm going to leave a page of links. Now, all of this is, there it is. All of these are in the version of the my paper. I've just got a serialization of all of these bullets as if it were my paper. In your proceedings, you can find all of these links. CVA is currently under development, although we think after 18 months, we think that all of the features that, or most of the features people need are already in there. We're going to try and standardize CVA in the next 10 to 12 weeks. Generic code has already been standardized. There is an OASIS committee. I'm the chairman of the Codeless committee, where we've actually taken it out of the UBL committee and created a new committee because it applies to all documents with codes, not just UBL. And if you would like to help out our committee, we could certainly use the help, certainly use the new ideas. And as you leave here designing vocabularies for your users, I want you to think about codes or values as first-class information items that need to be managed. And I think XML provides great facilities for managing or at least interchanging that information. I'm not asking you to manage your codes using generic code. I'm only asking you to publish your codes in generic code as one of the published formats so that I can use those codes. So we have to make that distinction. We're not asking people, the custodians of code lists, to change the way they're doing their business. All we're asking is please make your codes available as generic code files. Ah, there's another appeal I can make to you as the audience. You have contacts with these people who are custodians of code lists. Could you please preach to them the benefits of publishing those codes as XML documents so that they can be interchanged, so that our programs can take advantage of them? So I'm here for both days and then breaks. I'd love to talk more about this. I'll entertain questions now, but thank you for letting me get away from the angle brackets for a while. Yes, Michael.
Ken, I think you've made two points which are extremely good.
Okay. we'll discount the others.
What is the sort of separation of structural validation from
value validation?
And the other is the need for customizing validation according to what data flow is occurring.
Yes.
I think my issue with it
No.
Don't
make them orthogonal. They need to be separate. I can see in 1.1 how I can conflate those two in a single pass.
If one takes the need for customization, and I build a system with a client where in a particular workflow, a particular field in a document has to have the value approved.
I'm sorry.
A particular field in a particular document has to have the value approved.
Yes.
Because it's not allowed to go on that stage of the workflow unless it's
Unless it's approved, okay.
But also, on that workflow, a particular part of the document that in other places is optional is mandatory. So I've not only customized the value set to say it's got to be approved, but also customized the grammar.
Yeah, okay, for those who can't hear, sometimes codes might impact grammatical constraints elsewhere in the document.
I wouldn't say that's the code impacting the grammar, and I'd say it's the workflow customizes the schema, and it customizes both the value set and the grammar.
I guess it would, yes. Yeah.
So I think what I'm trying to argue is that the issue of customization of the schema according to the particular workflow is orthogonal to the distinction between value and structuralization.
Okay. As a committee in UBL, we're creating a set of labels, and we're asking our users to impose their own constraints on those labels from what you're saying. We will decide to make things optional. Most constructs in UBL are optional, and it would be up to a deployment in order to make that workflow association of changing the grammar for a particular state in the workflow. And that certainly is allowed in from a UBL interchange perspective, is that a community can choose to, on the fly, in their community, change the constraints. They can't change the labels or the positions or create a set of constraints that violate, that an instance can no longer be valid. No, let's put it that, that the instance they're creating can't still be a UBL 2.0 instance. So that is being accommodated. I agree with you that differing paths. I'm trying to think on the fly here about this orthogonality. So you're saying that. Well, I think I agree with you. Yeah, that. Yes. My goal here though was to really focus on the code part of it. Certainly you could read a generic code file and synthesize a set of W3C schema assertions, or say enumerations, and then read the CVA file and synthesize some 1.1 assertions so that I could read both of those components, the UBL schema and the CVA file, and synthesize a single 1.1 schema that incorporates all of that. I could see that happening quite straightforwardly. Yes?
One thing, you mentioned two instances of Thames and two and several instances of Columbus.
Yes.
And isn't that really a namespacing problem? Don't we need the namespace?
It's a value space issue. Namespaces are good. I tell my students that a namespace is a dictionary. Names might have different meanings in different dictionaries. They might have different namespaces. If I choose to Is your claim that we need to somehow put a namespace value in the metadata?
Absolutely.
That can definitely be a canonical version URI. One of the pieces of list level metadata, actually I've just, one of the versions of list level metadata is declaring right there. Canonical URI and canonical version URI. I can choose, as the custodian of this list, to have as my instance level metadata a URI as the distinguishing string. And so I could put a namespace URI there. Yes, but because of this distinct, because of list level metadata and your provision of instance level metadata to do the distinction, yes.